right, welcome to day 137 of Journey Through Scripture. Today we're going to be looking at Ruth chapters 3 and 4, Psalm 62, and then John chapter 10 verses 1 through 21. Okay, Ruth 3 and 4. So Ruth and Naomi have been benefiting from Boaz's kindness in his giving Ruth a lot extra than she would have received normally gleaning from his fields during barley harvest. And Naomi hatches this plot, this idea. Basically, Boaz is going to be winnowing his barley at the threshing floor. And so Ruth, why don't you wash yourself, anoint yourself, put on your cloak, and when he lies down, the wording is uncover his feet and lie with him, and he will, quote, tell you what to do. Now, what she seems to be suggesting is that Ruth no longer present herself as someone who is mourning. Okay, these same kind of actions, the washing, the anointing, putting on the cloak, are also present in 2 Samuel 12:20 when David comes out of a state of mourning. And Ruth would have been in this mode for quite some time. It's been a significant amount of time has transpired here. And the cloak also, it's been suggested, may be purposely intended to make it clear to Boaz that Ruth is not a prostitute or an adulteress of some sort who is propositioning him. So this is a non-provocative way to dress. This is a cloak, a simlah in Hebrew, is simply an outer garment. It's nothing fancy. Poor people like Ruth would have used it also for a blanket. So she goes down there, and Boaz eats, drinks, his heart becomes merry. I don't think that that necessarily suggests that he's drunk, but you know, he's filled, he's satiated. He's having a good time. Harvest is a bit of a festive thing. And he lies down, and then Ruth goes and does as her mother-in-law has suggested. She comes, she uncovers him, she lays next to him. And at midnight, it says, he's startled. Behold, there's a woman there. And Ruth says, you know, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. All right, now there's a bunch of different stuff we can look at here. First of all, I want to note that the spreading of wings over the servant is the same kind of language that Boaz used in chapter 2, verse 12, when he first met Ruth, where he says, may Yahweh repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by Yahweh, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. There, of course, referring to the extraordinary kindness that Ruth has shown to Naomi. Now, I'd kind of be remiss if I didn't address something of an elephant in the room in this passage, and that is that the entire scenario is kind of sexually charged. There are a number of euphemisms that are used here that are sometimes suggestive of sexual encounters. Words like uncover, to lie with. The suggestion has also been made that feet is sometimes used in the Hebrew Bible as an euphemism for male genitals. That's a little unlikely here. First of all, that is in itself kind of doubtful. Like, there's no place where it's like obviously the case. But more than that, this is not the typical word that's used for feet. It is linguistically related to it, but the word that's actually used for feet here actually only occurs one other time in the Old Testament, where it's in Daniel 10:6, where it's parallel to entire arms. So it might actually be legs, which would obviously weaken the idea of feet being used here as code for Boaz's man parts. I think it's noteworthy, however, that this text stops short of actually implying sexual acts. So the idea is, I think that this is risky. It's a risky proposal, right? That this is she's being told to do something pretty bold here that could easily be mistaken. She's kind of at the mercy of Boaz, but because they know that Boaz is a good man, They trust him to do the right thing here. Now, usually when all these suggestive terms here are used for the act of sex, the context makes it clear that that's what happened. But here, you can't really find that. So when she uncovers his entire legs, she's peeling back the blanket so that the night chill awakes him, and that's why he wakes up at midnight and sees that she's there. What appears to be the case is that this is a proposal for marriage, and Boaz seems to clearly take it that way. It is risky, as I said. It could just as easily have been seen as an attempt at seduction, but Naomi seems confident that Boaz's integrity and God's sovereign hand will make it so that this is interpreted in the right way, as a way in which a lower class woman is approaching a powerful man to propose marriage, which is unusual, right? It's usually not the woman who would suggest such a thing. And the usual social channels would be things like a family arranged marriage. But if their situation is going to be bettered and they see this opportunity, they have to kind of take matters into their own hands and do something. And again, we need to be careful not to assume things that the text does not say. Now, one thing that the text does say is what Boaz said, starting in verse 10, where he says, "May you be blessed by Yahweh, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich." So there's two acts of kindness, and this is that word that we've seen a bunch of times in Ruth, this chesed, this loving kindness, this faithfulness. So here he's speaking of two acts. The first one, of course, being staying with her widowed mother-in-law, and doing so has enabled her to care for Naomi, who is a widow. So here you have a young widow caring for an older widow when she didn't have the obligation to do so, and that is obviously an act of chesed. And here now is a second act of chesed, and that is rather than going after young men, either poor or rich. So the idea is that Ruth has options, and one of her options would be to go after another husband and to be married into his family. And that would be not only sayonara to Naomi, but it would also end up basically ending that family line right there. Instead, she is doing, she is pursuing a course of actions where should Boaz accept this, right? She makes herself vulnerable to him in the hopes that he will accept this proposal, which would allow the family line to continue. Okay, because this is not just merely marriage, but she says, you are a redeemer. And remember from the law of Moses how that functions. Now, as we will see in the scene that plays out in chapter 4, things become a little bit clearer as to how that works in this specific situation. What appears to be going on is this. Elimelech, who is Naomi's deceased husband, would have had family land in Israel, right? And there's a famine, so he becomes poor because he's unable to produce for himself. Now, there are several things that would happen in that case, one of which is apparently that he would have had to sell his land. Now, land would be eventually returned in the year of Jubilee, although this is the period of Judges, and it's even questionable as to whether or not the years of Jubilee are actually being honored and observed. Whether they are or not, the land is not in their family's possession and would have to be redeemed back, would have to be bought back. And it's the right of a close relative to do that. Naomi does not have a legal claim on the land. And so they need a close relative who would be good enough to purchase this land back from whomever Elimelech had to sell it to, before he got so desperate that he had to leave the land of Israel and go to sojourn in Moab so that they would have some food. Now, the other piece of this is that to exercise the right of a redeemer to this kinsman redeemer here also is relevant in terms of progeny and the laws of levirate marriage, which I have discussed. This is back in Deuteronomy 25, which is a series of basically provisions for what to do in terms of the poor and the destitute in the land. So a woman's, you recall the Sadducees questioned Jesus with this presumed in the background as well, where a brother dies, and then his brother, if he has no offspring, his brother then is expected to have relations with the deceased brother's widow, and to take her as his own wife, and the children who would be born would then be counted as the original brothers. Now, if there aren't brothers available to do this, either they're unwilling or there just aren't other brothers, then it's unclear what is to happen after that. So it's often pointed out that what is being pursued here by Boaz taking this responsibility upon himself is a fulfilling of the spirit of the law as well, that he's technically not required to do this, but that he would be willing to do it. And note that this, too, is considered an act of chesed on Boaz's part, because he's going to have sons with this woman potentially, but they will not be counted as his own heirs, right? These are counted as someone else's heirs. And just another quick reminder here that this does not appear to have been something where women are being exploited. In fact, it seems that this is actually something that that Israelite women would desire, because there's such a high value on family. There's such a high value on having children, and it means that much to them that you would have something like in Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10, this law that prescribes like what she is to do to a brother who's unwilling to do this, that she actually gets in his face, pulls his sandal off, and spits in his face. So that this is seen in this culture as a dishonor towards her, and she like takes the initiative for publicly shaming the brother who refuses to do this. But at any rate, in the book of Ruth, this seems to be something that Ruth is more than willing to do. In fact, she's going out of her way and being particularly vulnerable here, placing herself in this vulnerable situation in order to make it happen. So the proposed scenario here is an act of chesed, both on the part of Ruth towards Naomi and her deceased husband's family, and it's an act of chesed on Boaz's part as well. So fast forward now to chapter 4. Boaz goes to the gate of the city. He agrees to do this, and he goes to the gate of the city, which is where business is conducted, and he gets a hold of 10 of the city elders, as well as this man who is the closer family relative, the closer redeemer, and he presents the situation to them. And this nameless guy is willing to redeem this field. Now, you might recall a moment ago, I mentioned that the likely scenario in the background here is that that this field had been sold prior to their move to Moab and is not in their family's possession. However, there are other things in the text that suggest that Naomi is in control of the field to some extent, right? She's described as selling it, and it says here that he, in verse 5, that he would be buying the field from the hand of Naomi. And I just think that those are expressions that that still acknowledge her technical possession of it, although she doesn't have legal possession of it. That it is indeed her field that he's acquiring, and so that's the language that's used. The idea of selling, most of the commentaries acknowledge, even ones that would disagree slightly with me as to the background here, acknowledge that this is probably not a straight up act of selling. The language for to sell can often be used simply to give. Think of the book of Judges, for example. The Lord sold Israel into the hands of those around her. So it can have a much less, it could be used in a much more general sense of giving as opposed to specifically some kind of monetary transaction. And I just think that this makes the most sense of the concept of redemption going on here, of a redeemer being required The other way of explaining this would be that what is at stake here is mainly usufruct of the land, that is acquiring the land and taking care of it so it doesn't, for time being, so that it doesn't continue to lie fallow, so that it can now be worked, and that he would essentially be buying the right to use the land to produce his own crops or something. I just don't think, I don't see why a redeemer is needed for that situation. So I suppose here the difference in interpretation of the background here depends on whether or not depends on whether or not you give weight to the language of selling, or if you give weight to the language of redemption. I'm obviously going with the latter, but either way, I think we can really appreciate the theological message of the book, that this is God using the very ordinary life circumstances of trial and hardship and people acting in faithfulness to bring about good, to bring about redemption, to provide for the poor and the needy. And he's doing it through the hands of those who are faithful, those who are bold. You know, you also have a tremendous moral integrity presented in the character of Ruth. In fact, she's called an Eshet Chayil, a worthy woman, as it's translated in chapter 3, verse 11 by Boaz. And interestingly, if you're familiar with the book of Proverbs, you know that Proverbs ends in chapter 31 with the praise of an extraordinary woman, an extraordinary wife, who is there called an Eshet Chayil. And interestingly, in the Hebrew order of the books, that is in the order of the books in the Hebrew Bible, Ruth actually comes after Proverbs, and it's been suggested, I remember Brevard Childs suggests this, that that reason being is that, you know, when you're reading through, you read Proverbs 31, and then you read Ruth, and Ruth is an illustration of the Eshet Chayil, the worthy woman. And worthy might not even be the best. Chayil is also often used as the word for mighty, or something like a mighty woman. But yeah, all that to say that whatever your understanding of is exactly what's going on here in the background, you know, we can appreciate the message that the book is giving to us. So at any rate, this closer redeemer here, back to the city gate, right? This closer redeemer is willing to buy the field, presumably. I don't know if we can impute terrible motives to this guy, because that, you know, we just don't know that much about him or about what it's saying about him. But it appears to be the case that he's willing to do it when he will acquire the field and, you know, can perhaps profit off of it a little bit. But then when he's told the second part of the deal, which would be acquiring Ruth the Moabite, the widow, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, at that point the guy refuses to do it, and he says, lest I impair my own inheritance. So he gives the right of redemption to Boaz. Now, interestingly, the spitting in the face ceremony doesn't happen here. It's unclear why. Maybe that is a purely optional thing. It might be that Ruth is not a native Israelite, or it might be that Boaz is willing to do it, and so it's not seen as that much of a problem. No harm, no foul. But what we do have is that the man draws off his sandal and gives it to Boaz, as it says, this was the manner of attesting in Israel. I think it's interesting that this, the way we see this described, right, this was the custom in former times, indicates that the story of Ruth itself predates significantly the time when it was actually written, when it was actually written down. Of course, we don't know when it was actually written down, but at any rate, this idea of a sandal being exchanged, and you can see the same imagery of the sandal there in the Deuteronomy 25, the shame ritual there, the shaming ritual, that there the woman removes his sandal for him and then spits in his face, whereas here, in order to indicate the transfer of right of redemption, the man removes his own sandal and gives it to the one who is receiving the right of redemption. And indeed, this is what happens. And Boaz takes Ruth to be his wife. And then you have these blessings. And it's always interesting to me when one biblical text kind of references another. So here, the people who are at the gate say, "We are witnesses. May Yahweh make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah." Of course, Jacob's wives from Genesis. "Who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." Again, Genesis, good old Genesis, Genesis 38. Okay. And yeah, so then it goes and it talks about how they were married and they did have a son. Perhaps more children as well, but the one who is focused on here is a son named Obed, whom Naomi ends up being who's given to Naomi as she's to be his nurse, obviously not to nurse him, but to care for him. And Obed meaning servant, probably a shortened form of Obadiah, and the servant of the Lord is what that name would be. And we're told that this is the father of Jesse, the father of David. So God working in this extraordinary way through these people who are showing chesed to one another, and makes it so that this outsider, this Moabite woman, is inserted into the lineage of the one who will eventually be arguably Israel's greatest king, at least during the time of the monarchy, and that is King David. All right, well, that's it for the book of Ruth. Let's go over and take a look at Psalm 62. Psalm 62, speaking of David, is another Psalm of David. And here we have we have a beginning. "For God alone my soul waits in silence," the first two verses, right? "From him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken." And then we have the it shifts perspective, speaking to those who are attacking him, those who have set themselves against him. "How long will all of you attack a man to batter him like a leaning wall, a tottering fence? They only plan to thrust him down from his high position. They take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse." Right? They're hypocrites. They're double-tongued. And then you have that refrain that we began with. "For God alone my soul wait in silence." It's virtually the same thing in Hebrew, so there's a slight difference in preposition there. For my hope is from him. And then again, verse 2 is repeated. He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be shaken. David here, of course, using this standard imagery that we find so much in the psalm of God being a rock, of him being a fortress, and therefore David being unshakable, because I rest in him. On God rests my salvation and my glory. My mighty rock, my refuge is God. Whom do we take refuge when things are going wrong, when we are being pursued by people who hate us, or when our world is collapsing around us? And then verse 8 directs the worshipers, "Trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us." This image of pouring out your heart, right? Like taking what is in your heart and giving it to God. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Letting God in. Okay. "Those of low estate are but a breath. Those of high estate are a delusion. In the balances they go up. They are together lighter than a breath." Okay, that whether you're high, whether you're low, compared to God, you're nothing. But God, on the other, so you're a breath, right? Again, whether you're of high estate or of low estate, you are a delusion, even, right? But God is a rock, a fortress. In him is salvation, right? So that contrast there between even the greatest among us and God. "So put no trust in extortion. Set no vain hopes on robbery. if riches increase, set your not your heart on them. So, like, just because you gain doesn't mean that you're going to be doing well. Doesn't mean that that's something worth trusting in. These riches that you've gotten for yourself, and here specifically through sordid means. Once God has spoken, twice I have heard this, that power belongs to God, and that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love, for you will render to a man according to his work, according to the things he does, which is both convicting and terrifying, right? You know, if you do right, God does not overlook the things that you have done in his name. But know also that you are in need of his mercy, because it is none of us have works that can stand up to his holiness. I want to point also out here in verse 11, this figure of speech where a number will be given and then another. Once God has done this, twice have I heard this. Okay, same kind of thing, like in Proverbs, six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to him, that kind of thing. We see this also a lot in the book of Amos. Well, we will see there when we eventually get to Amos. That's not where we're going now, though. We're going to John chapter 10. So John chapter 10 is where Jesus begins using the metaphor of himself as a shepherd. And the shepherd is often applied to kings in Israel. In fact, we will see this very shortly in the book of Samuel, where shepherding in the narrative appears to function in a way to kind of point to David being a competent king, that kind of thing, and a bunch of other places. So it's, of course, extraordinary when Psalm 23, the shepherd of Israel says, "The Lord is my shepherd." And at any rate, this is how Jesus speaks here, and he still is, for what we can tell, in Jerusalem. Remember, there's no chapter divisions initially, so this is right on the heels of the healing of the blind man. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter by the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief or a robber. Okay, so there's sheep. They're in a sheepfold. There's a door, the true way to enter, but there are those who enter, but not by the door. Okay. And those people are thieves and they're robbers. Okay. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. So who comes in through the door? Who comes in like he owns the place? Who belongs there? It's the shepherd. And the gatekeeper, the one who watches the door, opens it to him. And the sheep hear his voice. He calls them by name and leads them out. And when he has brought out all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers. So here you have this picture of discipleship as we follow Jesus because we know his voice. When we hear him, we hear our master, and we follow him just as sheep do. We know that with him we are safe, and he guides us and leads us to pastures and cares for us and defends us and lays down his life for us. Here's this idea that the true people of God hear Jesus's voice and know that he is their Lord, he is their master. And then this figure of speech Jesus used with them, John tells us, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. So this is kind of like one way in which this shepherding metaphor is. So that here he is the shepherd, and he's going to say that he's the shepherd again. But before he does that, he's going to kind of give them another version of this metaphorical illustration. Truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. So now here he's describing himself as the door. So that is, he's the way in to being within the fold. If you want to go into the fold, you have to come through him. This is, you know, no one comes to the Father except through me. 14:6, he'll say that, right? This kind of thing. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the door, and if anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. So if you want to be a part of the sheep, you have to enter by the true door. That is Jesus. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. and the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. So now we start seeing the character of the good shepherd. He's willing to lay down his life for the sheep. Now, at this point, I think it's worth noting that Jesus is probably basing this off of a promise from the Old Testament in Ezekiel chapter 34. And without getting into too many details there, Ezekiel is commanded to prophesy against the shepherds of Israel, the leaders, the priests, the kings, the elders, those who have been leading the people astray. And those are false shepherds, right? And it even says that they're clothing themselves with the wool. They're happy to do that. They're happy to eat the fat from the fat ones whom they slaughter. But when it comes to actually strengthening the weak or healing the sick or bounding up the injured or bringing back the strays, they fail. Okay? They don't really care. They're like the hired hands whom Jesus will talk to here, right? He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. And so eventually in Ezekiel 34, God gets to the promise part where he says, I myself will shepherd this flock. I'm going to judge before them. I will rescue those whom you have irresponsibly scattered. And then verse 23 in Ezekiel 34, I will set up over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he shall feed them. He shall feed them and be their shepherd. And I, Yahweh, will be their God, and my servant David shall be prince among them. I am Yahweh, I have spoken. So here Jesus appears to be claiming this for himself. I am this shepherd who will come, the servant David who will come and shepherd God's people. So there's also this idea of not only that the sheep know him, they know his voice and they follow him, but also he lays down his life for them. And in verse 17 and 18, he says, I lay down my life that I may take it up again. Of course, an allusion to his resurrection. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and I have authority to take it up again. Okay, so Jesus is not, you know, this passive victim here, right? That just, no, this, when Jesus goes to the cross, he wants us to understand this is him purposely laying down his life for us and purposely taking it back up again. He has authority to do both. And at no point is Jesus lost control. At no point is he simply the victim of brutality. This is something he voluntarily gives himself to, because as he says, this charge I have received from my Father. And I think that's an important component of how we are to understand Jesus' cross. Yes, it is a time of weakness, of humiliation, of suffering, but it is something that Jesus does fully of his own accord and in full alignment with the fullness of who he is. And as a result of Jesus saying these things, again, we've seen John likes to talk about the banter among the people. He says, again, there was a division among the Jews because of these words. Jews probably being the religious establishment, many of them are saying he has a demon and he's insane. Why listen to him? Hear the stuff he's saying. Others say, these are not the words of one who is oppressed by a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind? Again, this is still the same scene that we saw yesterday. Okay, well, that's it for today. As always, I thank you for joining me. And until we are back here tomorrow, keep reading scripture, take care, and bye-bye.